she said bluntly. It needs someone to rise up and take the position once occupied by Lord Farrell. A Lieutenant Lord Vect, albeit with a greater degree of loyalty. I could take that role by force, she continued, injecting her voice with an easy casualness, but I would be opposed by those unwilling to concede what they might perceive as a closely matched war, and the price would be high on all sides. If the cabals of Port Tavar were to be too greatly weakened, she added, sensing another scornful dismissal on the homunculus's lips, then who is to say that forces from a neighbouring realm might not intrude? Forces that would have no ties to the other entities within Port Tavar, and no qualms about eliminating those they found here.
You seek a closer alliance, then, Maculitic said. You wish for my open support in order to become Lady of Port Tavar.
I can become Lady of Port Tavar whenever I please, Dimera countered, substituting confidence for strict truthfulness. I am suggesting this alliance to make it quicker and easier, and allow us to return our attention to the real space vermin. If my cabal of the Hollow Heart comes to prominence, why should your coven of the Red Harvest not rise along with us? Maculitix tapped his index fingers together.
Let us speak plainly, then. Even combined, our forces would be insufficient to guarantee the capitulation of all other interested parties. There are other alliances within Port Tavar, some of which you will know, some of which I know, and some, I have no doubt, that are unknown to us both. We would need the assistance of at least one witch cult, for example.
I concur, Dimera said, nodding as though Maculitix had said something insightful as opposed to blindingly obvious. The cult of the Silver Shards is thought to be the largest, but there is little prospect of them joining us. I would propose...
One moment, please,
Maculitix said, holding up one of his more natural hands while the other went to his ear.
I mean, no disrespect, Lady Dimera, but...
Dimera schooled her face to neutrality, then added in the faintest hint of displeasure. The very image of an Archon annoyed by this gross rudeness, but willing to tolerate it, for now, in the name of their common interest. Her own ear pearl was silent. She was far beyond the reach of her cabal's carrier waves here, in the depth of the Red Harvest's domain. Nonetheless, she had a suspicion as to what urgent news had caused Maculitix to risk insulting her so.
There are Arrakia within the boundaries, Maculitix said a few moments later,
his voice balanced exactly halfway between disgust and fascination.
A sizable force. They appear to have pursued the so-called Cabal of the Wounding Wind.
In what district have they arrived? Dimera queried.
Sabergate,
Maculitix replied, his expression stern.
Pardon the interruption, Archon, but I believe this situation must take precedence.
Of course, Dimera agreed. They both made for the door that led back into the labyrinth and eventually to the surface. But the Arrakia have pursued the Wounding Wind back to Port Tavar. How can a Webway Gate have admitted them?
That is, unfortunately, beyond my ability to answer at present,
Maculitix replied. His scissor hand opened and closed its blades, which Dimera took as a sign of agitation. She herself was not agitated, although she made sure to tighten the corners of her eyes slightly in order to give that impression. After all, it would not do to let anyone know that the reason the Webway Gate had remained open for the Orcs was because she had arranged for it to do so. Chapter 4. For a while, Uftak was not convinced that what had at first seemed like an excellent idea was, in fact, an excellent idea. His truck plunged into the strange light that filled the scrawny's archway, and then there was... Well, he wasn't entirely sure. White, featureless, sort of misty... They appeared to be in a tunnel of sorts, but it felt as though the walls were pressing in and yet a long way away at the same time. Ufchak was unable to gain any real insight from the reactions of those around him either. The two grots were cowering in generalised fear, and Princess was happily chasing its own tail. Meanwhile, Mogrot wasn't paying attention to anything other than what was directly in front of him, specifically the receding shapes of the spiky vehicles. On the basis that it wouldn't do for a big boss to seem at all uncertain about either his decisions or the surroundings, Ufchak settled for staring belligerently ahead and seeing what happened. The spikies had to be going somewhere, after all.
"They're cheating, boss,"
Mogrot declared in outraged tones, pointing at their quarry.
"There's definitely something funny going on. They shouldn't be that far ahead of us."
Ufchak glared at the walls again, then back at the spikies. Hoots, hollers, and the roar of engines from behind him announced the arrival of more orc vehicles. But when he turned his head to look, it was just as hard to pin an exact location on any of them. One moment his lads seemed bunched up, the next spread out, and the noise reaching his ears appeared to bear little resemblance to either their proximity or direction.
"It's just scrawny nonsense," he said in reply to Mogrot's complaint. "It's a weird place, built by weird gits. Keep going fast and that'll be good enough." "You've got it, boss,"
Mogrot replied, content enough that his grievance had been heard and dealt with. It was certainly a smoother ride in here, Ufchak noted, which meant the skimmers ahead of them had actually lost some of their advantage. Being able to ignore terrain was great when your pursuers were hitting bumps all over the place, but was less of a benefit when the trucks and buggies in question were driving over something as smooth and even as any Humi road. Distance blurred, and one of the fleeing spiky trucks abruptly seemed closer than it had been. Ufchak opened fire with the shock rifle, but the tunnel was playing other tricks and his shot flew wide. That was definitely the explanation rather than he'd actually missed. Still, Ufchak consoled himself, that was fine. The object was to chase the spikies back to wherever they came from rather than blow them up before they got there. The spiky gun wagon still seemed to want to have a go, and it sent two beams of crackling darkness back at them, but they flew wide as well. Given how accurate scrawnies usually were, that suggested to Ufchak that it wasn't just him who was having trouble with calculating distances. That didn't make much sense. Why would scrawnies build something which was weird even to them? Did it mean they hadn't built this place at all? He shook his head before his thoughts could run away with him. Thinking was a hard habit to break once you got into it. Spend too long thinking, and you'd eventually realise that some git had taken your head off while it was busy doing something else. Ufchak had survived having his head stitched onto another body, and the doc's work had healed up so proper that you couldn't even really see the scar now. But that didn't mean he wanted to risk it a second time. He had no intention of falling victim to some sneaky blood axe type creeping up on him while he was wondering what stars ate or something. If it was a straight-up fight, then that was different. You went into those knowing you might not come out again in one piece or at all, and that was all part of the fun. As quick as blinking, things changed. What had been an almost featureless tunnel ahead of them as far as the eye could see suddenly turned into a massive portal, or an archway, or a gateway, something like that anyway, and the spiky vehicles flew through it without slowing. Ufchak braced himself, holding onto the truck's roll cage with one hand and the other clutching the shock rifle with the snazhammer slung across his shoulders. This was when they would see whether they could still follow the spikies or whether the cunning little gits had some way of turning this portal off that they hadn't used on the previous one. The front of the truck came into contact with the shimmering light, which swept backwards over the vehicle and its passengers with a cool tingling on Ufchak's skin, and they were through. The tunnel and its ethereal whiteness had disappeared. There was sky above them, of a sort, but Ufchak's eyes could tell at once that this wasn't proper sky. Not like you found on a planet where you might get clouds and flying gits that you could bring down and eat, or which might, depending on the size of them, try to eat you. There was no shape to a sky, it was just there. And sometimes you could see all the way up to the stars. This was different. It was a dome of almost unimaginable proportions and constructed of something that looked more like a force field than anything solid, but still, Uftak could tell, a dome. He could just make out strange patterns across its surface, but then his eyes seemed to shift and suddenly it was the other bits that were the patterns and the former pattern that was actually the surface. And then there were whole new bits that suddenly stood out in different ways that he hadn't noticed before. It was positively confusing. Uftak dealt with it the way he dealt with most things that confused him, or at least most things that confused him which he couldn't easily smash, and ignored it. The Spikies had a strange force field for a sky, good for them. It wasn't relevant to him or what he was doing here.
Wow, Mogra opined solemnly. This place is weird.
Although Mogrot's assessment of things was usually about as valuable as a grot's tooth, Uftak had to admit that he was right on this occasion. Mighty spires rose up around them beneath the force-filled sky. Great dark daggers that looked like little so much as malignant inverted icicles. They seemed almost fragile in their slenderness, but Uftak was disinclined to believe that assessment for two reasons. Firstly, although Spikies weren't exactly tough, they, their armour, and the things they built were surprisingly resilient for their size. Spiky armour thinner than Uftak's finger could stand up to a blow as well as a bit of metal as thick as his fist. Secondly, although distances were still a little difficult to judge, he was reasonably sure that a lot of the spires only looked thin because they were so zogging tall. They weren't the only strange thing. The portal had spat his truck out onto a wide plaza tiled in pale stone slabs, the surfaces of which were either naturally shaped or had been carved in a manner that suggested an endless tessellation of skulls and bones. Uftak wasn't sure which option was weirder. Some way off to his left ran a wide, dark strip of viscous filth that could only be called a river because it was moving at a slow walking pace, on which sat a variety of characteristically thin, sharp-edged vessels that had to have reinforced hulls given the amount of caustic chemicals Uftak could smell, even at this distance. And there were Spikies everywhere. On the river, scattered here and there across the plaza, clustered about the stalls that ringed it, and even zipping around in the sky on those weird floaty planks. Or, Uftak squinted to make sure he was seeing this right, with wings, actual wings coming out of their backs. Most of these Spikies weren't armed and armoured, not like the ones Uftak was chasing. He saw eyes turn towards his truck and weapons emerge from beneath clothing, but they weren't tooled up for a proper fight. This was just like wandering down to the Brew Boys with your favourite chopper tucked in your belt. All the same, there were enough of the gits to make problems for one truck containing two orcs, two grots and a squig. Then the rest of the war began to roar out of the portal behind him, and the mood around the plaza changed from murderously curious to panic. Spikies were sort of like grots, apparently. They relished the chance to stick a stabber into someone if they thought there was enough of them to get away with it, but had no interest in a fight for the fight's sake. Uftak saw blades that had just been drawn in anticipation of being applied to his flesh, now used on whoever was standing beside the wielder, in order to better facilitate their own getaway. Fellow Spikies were shoved aside or trampled underfoot. Stalls were smashed apart and their contents left scattered, and safety was sought through doors and down through hatches or grates.
All right, lads, Uftak bellowed. Let's give them a socking good kicking.
The war opened up with everything it had and raked the plaza with firepower that made up in brutal exuberance for what it lacked in accuracy. Chips of stone filled the air as cannons and shooters of every conceivable sort unloaded solid slugs and high explosive rounds and blew chunks out of the slabs on which their targets stood. Spy keys disintegrated as zappers and mega blasters unleashed bolts of ravening energy. An explosion shook the ground as stick bomb after stick bomb was hurled at anything that looked as if it might be vaguely amusing to blow up. Some of the spy keys fought back, of course. A few were braver or more bloodthirsty than others, or, in the case of some of those on the boats, maybe thought they were far enough away to be able to retaliate with some measure of safety. Boys fell out of vehicles, suddenly missing part of their head or with dark purplish threads crisscrossing their skin as the spiky's poison needles hit home and did their deadly work. A chorus of piercing screams heralded the arrival of the floaty plank riders, arrowing down out of the sky with their underslung weapons spitting toxic death and huge, double-bladed glaives glinting in the weak light cast by the strange, sickly-looking sun thing that floated somewhere high above. There was a large mob of them, but their ambition and aggression outweighed their ability. A handful of orcs fell to their guns, but the sheer volume of Daka sent back at the spiky shredded over half of them before they got close enough to use their glaives. The flying attackers decapitated or bisected a few more orcs with lightning-swift blows as they reached the convoy. Then they were dragged down and hammered flat by boots, dismembered by choppers, or simply plucked from their planks and hurled under the wheels or tracks of whatever vehicle was closest.
"Where to, boss?" Mogra asked. "Keep following them,"
Uftak told him, pointing at the vehicles they'd chased through the portal in the first place.
"They're the best chance of finding more spikies who actually want to scrap."
The spiky vehicles abruptly began to pull upwards. Instead of floating at roughly head height, they rose into the sky to leave the ground behind entirely. Uftak took a speculative shot at them with the shock rifle, out of annoyance more than anything else, but only succeeded in blasting a chunk out of the lower part of a spire. The spikies banked around it and then were gone, lost in the maze of narrow turrets, spindly walkways, and gravity-defying platforms that clogged the space between the spires like the threads of some giant, demented arachnid's web.
"Don't think I can get us up there, boss,"
Mogrot reported with some regret.
"Nah," Uftak said. "All right, stop the truck." "Boss?"
Mogrot asked, sounding the closest to outrage that Uftak had ever heard him.
"Just do it," he snapped.
And Mogrot obliged with his usual directness. He hammered on what passed for brakes, and the vehicle skidded to a halt with an ear-rending screech of abused tyres and a cessation of forward momentum that threw Nizquik and Snaggy against the flatbed's front in a confused tangle of limbs and high-pitched swearing. Other buggies and battle wagons roared past them as the wire continued to spread out and push farther into this strange place, like a green flood released from behind a dam, finding old watercourses and making new ones. Uftak turned on the spot, surveying his surroundings. Part of him, a large part of him, had the urge to push on with his lads, knocking seven shades of squig dung out of any spiky he encountered, and generally have a good time. But that treacherous thinking had raised its ugly head again. Spikies couldn't take a punch, but they hit hard, or sharp, and almost never came from where you'd expect them to. This was Spiky City. So there were going to be a lot more of the gits somewhere, and they weren't going to take kindly to the wire's intrusion. Uftak knew that if his boys lined up and charged an equal line of spikies, then there was only going to be one outcome. But the spikies weren't going to make war like that. They'd set traps and draw a couple of mobs off at a time, then pin them down and thin them out before anyone else could turn up to join the scrap. It wasn't so bad, since no orc really objected to the idea of dying. It was just something that happened. And then either there was nothing, in which case you wouldn't care, or you eventually came back into a new body and got to do it all over again. Still, Uftak was quite pleased with where he'd ended up in this life, and intended to make the most of it rather than starting again from scratch. He wanted to have a really good fight, then nick a bunch of prize loot and head back to the rest of the tech wire to show off what an awesome boss he was. In order to do that, he needed this to go well, which meant he needed to be ready to outthink the Spikies, who were undoubtedly going to have their own ideas about how many of them should die and who should end up holding their loot.
"This quick, Snaggy," he said, looking around at the various buildings and spires and trying to decide which looked the most promising. "Go and get the boffin."
Chapter 5. Snaggy Little Tooth followed Nisquick, and he seethed. None of this was fair. None of this was how it was supposed to go. He'd been granted a vision by Gorkum Mork, where he'd been shown how it was his destiny to become the Grot Boss and raise Grots above their brutish and dim-witted so-called masters, with Snaggy raised above the other Grots, naturally, as was only proper. He'd done everything right, too. He'd single-handedly killed his old war boss. Okay, the falling Gargant had helped, but who'd caused it to fall? He'd amassed a loyal following. He'd done what old Morgrub the Warped had said and led his supporters to find the Scrawny's Gate under the Humey City. They got there first. Morgrub had said that the first orc to reach it was the god's choice to become war boss. So it stood to reason that if a Grot got there first, then he would become the Grot boss. But, of course, it hadn't panned out that way. Morgrub had betrayed his own prophecy and the will of the very gods he claimed to serve, and Snaggy had been cheated of his destiny. He'd been first through the gate, oh yes, but only because General Usbrag, that blood-axe git, had kicked him through it. It had been the General who proclaimed himself war boss, and all the orcs just went along with it, as though it was right. As though Gork and Mork hadn't definitely said it should be Snaggy. Then there'd been an awful lot of unpleasantness inside those weird, misty tunnels, which Snaggy had avoided by clinging to the underside of a truck. He'd had an argument with himself about it, because that was hardly the act of a great and noble Grot Boss, but he won said argument by pointing out to himself that if that particular war was going to ignore the will of the gods, they didn't deserve his help. As a result, he didn't know exactly what happened, other than there was a lot of fighting at some point, and whoever was driving his truck ended up either chasing or running away from the Scrawnies, right out of another gate and onto the planet where Snaggy was found by what he'd learned was a branch of the Tekwar. And then, after everything he'd been through, after his glorious triumphs of being brought low by the most heinous of treacheries, he was right back where his hogging started. Just a Grot to be bullied, kicked around, sat on and threatened with death or dismemberment by any orc that felt like it. It was as though Gork and Mork didn't even care that their will had been thwarted. However, what made it even worse was that this time he had to put up with Nisquick. Nisquick was, to Snaggy, everything a Grot shouldn't be. He was a walking insult to Grotdom. A living, breathing, arguably not thinking example of why orcs felt they were justified in pushing Grots around and making their lives a misery. In Nisquick's case, Snaggy was prepared to concede that they had a point. It wasn't just that the other Grot was stupid. It was that he was painfully stupid. Nisquick lived, so far as Snaggy could lower his intelligence to understand it, in some fantasy world where everything was as it should be, and his continual abuse and humiliation at Uftak's hands were just a part of life. The fact that Uftak sometimes, but only sometimes, called that monster princess off from trying to eat Nisquick was seen as an act of favour. The designation to him of menial tasks like fetching and carrying became, in Nisquick's head, statements of trust in his capabilities and reliability. He had no concept of the fact that Uftak clearly only kept him around so that he definitely knew the name of someone to blame for anything that went wrong. The fact that Uftak booted him around as he pleased, but didn't actually kill him, got filed, with a cheery and imbecilic grin, under could be worse. Even more infuriatingly, Nisquick's stunning lack of intellect not only inured him against treatment that should have led him down the road of bitterness and hatred, but also made him almost impossible to insult. Oh, Snaggy had tried. He'd slipped delicate knives of sarcasm or disparagement into his remarks, determined to needle Nisquick and make him realise how unpleasant his life was. But Nisquick never noticed. Sarcasm was taken at face value and led to Nisquick patiently explaining to a fuming Snaggy whatever it was he thought Snaggy had misunderstood, or accepting it as a compliment and beaming, depending on the nature of the conversation. Snaggy had considered grabbing Nisquick by the shoulders and yelling into his face exactly what he thought of him. But, well, when it came down to it, Nisquick was possibly just a little bigger than Snaggy, and certainly not intelligent enough to realise that he was faced by the saviour of Grotkind and the divinely ordained ruler of all Orkdom. A direct confrontation was not strategically wise, and it wouldn't benefit Grotdom as a whole if its Grot boss ended up folded over and loaded into Mech Zagnit's special bomb launcher or similar. To cap it all off, the final loogie of insult on the steaming squig-dung pile of injury was that Snaggy was realising he actually resented Nisquick, was envious of him, when he should have been viewing the other Grot with nothing more than contempt. Uftak hardly ever called Princess off from trying to eat him. Snaggy had to escape the ravening ball of teeth and hatred on his own. Nisquick might be abused and kicked and blamed by his master, but he was still the big boss Grot, and that gave him a bit of standing with the other Grots, who were hesitant to shank him just in case Uftak decided to splat them for it. Snaggy had no illusions that such retaliation would be out of any fondness for Nisquick, simply outraged that someone else had decided to end a life which the big boss viewed as his to do with as he pleased. But the protection existed nonetheless. Snaggy might be back to being just a Grot, but he found himself hanging around Uftak and Nisquick in the desperate, self-loathing hope that he could claw some similar dregs of status for himself. Why was he cursed with greatness? Why was he doomed to live a life of misery and suffering thanks to realising the unfairness of his lot when his companion, for lack of a better, more acerbic term, existed in a state of comparatively blissful ignorance? Why had Gork and Malk chosen Snaggy to rule if they were going to make it so zogging hard for him to do so? Snaggy scurried along, glaring at Nisquick's back as they dodged this way and that to avoid the onrushing vehicles of the Wahr in full flow, and envisaging scenarios that began with his stabber and ended in the other Grot's gizzards. They got most of the way back to the portal before the oncoming traffic began to slow a little. The front runners of the warband, the fast-moving bikes and buggies, were through and already causing chaos in their new surroundings. However, the portal hadn't shut and now the rest of the force was emerging. Mob after mob of boys with no truck or battle wagon on which to hitch a ride, and the larger mechanical walkers, the Killercans, Death Dreads and the like. Snaggy stared up at the huge arch in shock as the light filling it rippled once more, then parted to admit a massive, horizontal hollow pipe far, far above. A moment later, this was revealed to be the death cannon of an immense stomper, as the massive monstrosity's other weapons breached the surface, followed by the curving shape of its body and the baleful red-eyed gaze of its head. Snaggy looked up at it and had a momentary happy memory of pulling the lever that dropped the head of a mega-gargant, even bigger and stompier, onto his old war boss, before being abruptly shaken out of his reverie by the stomper's first titanic footstep on this side of the portal.
"It's coming this way!" Nisquick wailed. "Leg it!"
He tore off in a sprint at a right angle, big feet flapping. Snaggy growled under his breath, but headed after his fellow Grot as fast as his own legs could carry him, not because he felt that Nisquick was likely to have any particular ability to avoid trouble, but so that if they ran into something a bit more personal than the stomper, a small group of angry spikies, for example, he would have someone nearby to shove into their path while he made his getaway. The stomper didn't look as if it should be able to do much more by way of locomotion than shuffle along, But the thing's sheer size was deceptive, and although its legs were short in comparison to its body, they were still long enough to carry it leisurely forward as fast as a grot could run. It was a somewhat hairy handful of seconds before Snaggy finally managed to get out of the massive war machine's path, and he flopped down into a relieved heap as it cruised by him in a cloud of smoke, sounding an assortment of bells, whistles, and aggressive horns. One of its super rockets, a gigantic cylindrical munition that was itself at least the size of an orc, ignited and thundered off to detonate somewhere in the distance. The explosion was followed by a hollow cracking sound that carried to Snaggy's ears even over the noise of the wire around him, and the top half of one of the dark spires began to list before falling with what seemed like languid slowness. The crash of that hitting shook the ground just as much as the stomper's footsteps, despite being much farther away, and everyone cheered in general approval of the wanton destruction.
"Boffin!" Nisquick piped up, jumping up and down and waving. "Boffin!"
Amazingly, and certainly more by luck than judgment, the git had found the very orc they'd been sent in search of. Snaggy got back to his feet and surreptitiously brushed himself down. The Boffin was pretty smart as orcs went, which could go two ways. Either he was smart enough to recognise Snaggy's divine leadership abilities when Snaggy deigned to demonstrate them to him, or, if not that smart, he was still potentially smart enough to spot a coup before it was quite ready to be enacted. Either way, Snaggy didn't want Uftak's favourite mech to have any reason to dislike or distrust him more than was the norm for an orc where a grot was concerned. He stood straight and tried to look generally useful whilst letting just enough of his natural aura of greatness shine through to subliminally suggest that this was a grot who would be wasted by being sent to crawl inside a large machine to unstick a cog or deal with badly shielded cables carrying uncertain amounts of voltage. The Boffin rolled to a halt and glowered down at them.
"Oh, shoo. What?"
The good thing about the Boffin was that, given he lacked legs, his ability to casually kick a grot who was annoying him was markedly lower than most other orcs. All the same, it didn't pay to antagonise him, unless you wanted to become the test subject for his latest invention.
"The big boss is looking for you,"
Snaggy said quickly, just before Nisquick could get the words out. He pointed behind them in the general direction of where they'd left Uftak.
"He's over there. Said we should come and tell you."
Nisquick was staring at Snaggy with an expression of wounded betrayal. Snaggy ignored him, looking straight at the Boffin and desperately trying to keep control of the grin that was threatening to burst forward and spread all across his face. The Boffin grunted, which was as close to acknowledgement as an orc was likely to give a grot if no further information was required. The mech boy pivoted around on his wheel and raised his voice to bellow at his spanners, lesser mechs and grot assistants, all of whom were currently busying themselves with what Snaggy realised was De Boffin's workshop, hastily disassembled and brought along.
"You lot, get that set up while I see what the boss wants. Oi, Nazlug, careful with that. That's the special junk."
De Boffin whirled about again and zoomed off, skirting around a large mob of grots who had just emerged from the portal and were cowering and blinking in the strange, empty light of their new surroundings. Snaggy saw the mech boy bend low on a turn to scoop up a now ownerless floaty plank and place it over his shoulder as he straightened up, and then he was gone.
"I'm going to head back to find the boss,"
Nisquick said, his voice still full of hurt.
"Nice," Snaggy said. "Off you go, then."
Nisquick's face screwed up as he tried to process his next thought.
"You ain't coming?"
Snaggy shook his head.
"Nah, got something special to do. Something secret."
He leaned closer and lowered his voice to a hoarse whisper.
"Something the boss told me to do."
Nisquick jerked backwards in surprise, his eyes wide and mouth open in shock and disbelief. Then he gave a sharp, shuddering sniff, turned on the spot and marched off with his arms held stiff and his ears flat back against the side of his skull, leaving Snaggy giggling at having finally found a way to annoy his companion.
Nisquick wouldn't dare question Uftak about whether Snaggy's story was true. Imagine a grot wanting to know if a big boss had given another grot a secret mission. Just the concept made Snaggy laugh so much his stomach started to hurt. But even if he did, he'd just get booted for his impudence, which would be all the funnier. Snaggy didn't have to actually be Uftak's favourite to infuriate Nisquick. He just had to make the other grot think he was, which was going to be almost embarrassingly easy. However, that was just an amusing little side effect of the real reason Snaggy wanted Nisquick to zog off. He'd already seen one or two of the grots pointing at them, recognising the big boss's helpers. Snaggy could smell an opportunity like most grots could smell deep-fried squig legs. Snaggy could also smell deep-fried squig legs. And one was tickling his nostrils now. He threw his shoulders back, placed one hand on the grip of his sheathed stabber in an imposing manner, checked his blaster was ready to be drawn at a moment's notice if anyone gave him some lip, and sauntered towards the group with exaggerated casualness.
"All right, lads," he opened. "This is a strange old place, isn't it?"
"It's weird,"
one of the grots said, looking around him and shivering.
"Freaky. Don't like it."
"Yeah,"
Snaggy said, nodding sympathetically.
"Shame we had to come. This is more of an orc place, really, isn't it? Nothing much here for your average grot."
This statement was met with a few nods, but only a few. Even in the midst of a wise invasion of someone else's dimension, grots were always going to be hesitant about voicing criticism or dissatisfaction with orcs. A grot's lot might be a lowly and miserable one, but it was still usually better than getting stomped underfoot for bloody cheek or similar.
"Lucky for you lot, I can already tell you ain't average,"
Snaggy continued cheerfully, and a few heads came up.
"I've seen a lot of average in me life, and you ain't it."
A few more heads turned towards him. Grots were looking at each other uncertainly, trying to work out where he was going with this. Compliments were not a common currency amongst grots, but the nasty little hollow at the heart of every one of them began to seize on Snaggy's words and drink them down like an orc submerged in a vat of fungus beer. Eyes brightened and ears perked up. Snaggy didn't tell them that there were two ways to deviate from average, and he privately meant the other sort. Sometimes your audience did the hard work for you.
"Tell me,"
he said, sliding his way into the middle of them like a knife between the ribs.
"Have you lads ever heard of the Grot Boss?"
Chapter 6. There was a common belief in Camorra that power could not be given, only taken. This was not a view to which Dimera Thrake subscribed. Power, the sort of power in which most Drukhari were interested, not the everyday matter of energy harnessed from the Ilmia, the stolen suns that powered the Dark City, was intangible, unquantifiable. A glass might be full or empty or anything in between, and that state could be determined by a cursory glance. Such was the case with a splinter rifle's supply of ammunition, or even, with the correct expertise, the blood remaining in the body of an enemy undergoing exsanguination. These were mundane things, and so they could be measured in a mundane manner. Not so with power. Power, Dimera implicitly believed, came from the spirit. You could hold someone immobile with crude strength. Simple manacles of steel could keep them imprisoned, and a weapon could strike an enemy down so they could no longer disobey your will. But none of that conferred power. Power could not be achieved over the body, only over the spirit. When another being wished to disobey you, to harm you, but did not do so because they feared your strength or your chains or the death your weapons could deal, when they made the calculation of action versus consequence, and consequence triumphed, that was power. Similarly, when they looked to you for leadership, when they allowed your vision of what should happen to supersede theirs because they trusted that you were more knowledgeable or wiser or would deal swiftly with those who defied you, or they wished to reap the benefits of being your supporter, that was also power. None of these things could be achieved by an outside force, no matter how strong. The deadliest warrior might be able to slay any enemy who set themselves against her, but she could not compel any one of them to lay down arms. Power was given. More specifically, it was given up. Taking control of Port Tavar through bloodshed was possible, but it would be time-consuming and complicated and wasteful. Taking control through being the best option for the majority of its occupants was the easier way. Since this was Kamora, others would only consider Dimera's authority as being the best option for themselves until they could overthrow her. But anyone scared of a knife in the back had no business being near power in the first place. Dimera would seize control and eradicate her true enemies, then embark upon the delicate balancing act of keeping her new underlings so occupied with each other's schemes that they never had time to turn their attention to toppling her. First, however, she had to seize control. And the best way to do that, she had decided some time ago, was to show leadership in the face of a crisis. Since it was inefficient to wait for a crisis to occur, she'd had to manufacture one. Her brother had stumbled across the orcs and, through his arrogant near demise, provided her with the perfect opportunity. A vicious but easily manipulated foe, a desperate would-be Archon who thought he saw her duplicity and so never looked for a deeper motive. A small amount of webway sabotage, and her scheme was complete. Now she just had to capitalise. "Seal off Sabregate," she ordered, as soon as she reached a part of the Red Harvest's lair where her carrier waves could be sent and received once more. Mikulatix turned to look at her, but she was not addressing him.
"Yes, my lady," replied Ilioneth Zesk, her Drakon.
As commander of her Trueborn, Zesk served as the Cabal of the Hollow Heart's Master of Arms, and Dimera trusted him to act in her name, at least so far as she trusted anyone.
"Seal off Sabregate," Mikulatix repeated, a curious yet delighted smile troubling the pale worms of his lips. "How decisive. You would sacrifice the district."
"It is small and of little value," Dimera replied. Little value to her, of course, and, so far as she was aware, the same went for the Coven of the Red Harvest. That might not be true for other factions, but that would just mean they had all the more reason to support her efforts to eliminate the threat. After all, sealing off the district to prevent the orc filth from spreading any further was the logical course of action.
"We corral them there, gather forces, then move in and slaughter them. If we are swift, the damage they can do will be limited. I will make approaches to all those I believe will listen to a proposal of joint action. Will you do the same?"
Mikulatix strummed his fingertips together.
"Arrakia are of limited use and interest to me. They are blunt beings, barely sentient. My dungeons are better served hosting creatures that have a more refined appreciation of pain."
Dimera waited, refusing to be drawn. She was convinced that the homunculus saw the opportunity in being amongst the first to respond decisively to this threat, and she was not going to beg him for assistance. The Coven of the Red Harvest would be powerful allies, but if Mikulatix decided to spurn her after all, she would cast her net wider. She had no need to do so. After a couple more seconds, Mikulatix tilted his head slightly into a position more closely linked with unity and accordance.
"However, certain useful elixirs can be distilled from their vital fluids, and although the beasts have a disagreeably high tolerance for suffering, both physical and spiritual, I would still be intrigued to see exactly how far their notorious robustness can be stretched. A few subjects for such purposes would not go amiss."
"Then sharpen your blades and gather what allies you can," Dimera told him.
We will lead the cleansing operation, and Port Tavar will look to us for guidance.
She activated her carrier wave again.
Zesk, did any of the wounding wind make it out?
Yes, my lady.
Kill them,
Dimera said, ignoring Maculitix's look. The homunculus could speculate all he wanted in that twisted, paranoid mind of his, but no witnesses meant no proof.
They brought this plague down upon us, so they should be the first to pay for it with their lives.
Yes, my lady.
Master Homunculus,
Dimera said, bowing to her host.
I will take my leave of you now.
Of course, Master Archon,
Maculitix replied. His return bow matched her obeisance to the minutest fraction of a degree, but his eyes never left her face.
Good.
Let him remember it.
The corpses of the wounding wind lay strewn in the burning wreckage of their vehicles, not far from the now-sealed portal that led to the sub-realm of Sabergate. There were many other such portals, since Sabergate had been subsumed into Port Tavar some time ago, and now had sufficient links for Drukhari to move between the two relatively freely. It had links to a few other areas of Kamora as well, but it was to Port Tavar that it had the greatest connection, and to which it owed fealty. It was a minor area, in truth, little more than a slum that was, insofar as such things could be determined in somewhere like Kamora, on the outskirts of the Dark City. Sabergate might see raiding parties pass through, or return from real space bearing spoils, but such ventures usually moved on to grander locations before disposing of their trophies. Sabergate was unquestionably part of the Drukhari realm, but insignificant enough that its infestation was an offence rather than a disaster. As such, it made the perfect location for the orcs to despoil, provided they were not allowed to spread. Still, no Drukhari could countenance the insult of even the lowliest district of the Dark City being overrun by such filth. The orcs must be slaughtered and driven out, and the Cabal of the Hollow Heart would be at the forefront of such an attack. Dimera had already seized the initiative by ordering the portals out of Sabergate sealed. Now she had to ensure that none of her so-called peers, who might seek sport or vengeance in the district, could do so without fitting into her plans. By so doing, she would guarantee that others thought of her as a leader, and so ease her path to assuming the role of Port Tavar's ruler. She eyed the remains of her unwitting dupes from the platform of her personal venom. Did Archon Oridreed make it out?
We did not observe his armour, mistress, Zesk replied, which was as good as a no.
No Archon as desperate for recognition as Oridreed would stoop to dressing themselves in the raiment of one of their retainers. His very rank was a fiction he had to maintain at all times, precisely so that his few followers would continue to surrender their power to him.
There are no reports of him having exited through any of the other portals.
That might be feasible, taking his chances alone if he suspected that consequences awaited for leading the orcs back into Kamora. However, Zesk shook his head, his helmet's impressive crest whipping from side to side.
No, mistress. Some few fled the district before it was secured, but we have no indication that the Archon was amongst them.
No loose ends, then,
Dimera said with satisfaction.
Good.
She began to turn away from the spectacle, then froze as something caught her eye. It was a piece of midnight black armour that protruded from beneath the rear of a destroyed raider transport.
Zesk, she said, in a carefully controlled whisper. What is that? One incubus was aboard, Zesk replied. He died with the others.
Dimera clenched her teeth.
You killed an incubus?
This was a concern. She had hoped that Oridreed's bodyguards would have fallen protecting him. After all, incubi were devoted warriors who sought little more than to prove their supremacy by slaying as many foes as possible. His incubi would have heard their conversation when she sent him on his doomed hunt. And although the reasoning of her approach to him had been sound, and no one could blame her if a smaller cabal gravely underestimated the strength of their quarry,
It was still one more connection to her than she would have liked. More seriously, there was a difference between the incubi having fallen in battle against the orcs, something which would garner the support of the Shrine of the Last Breath for any attack on the invaders, and being gunned down on his return by her warriors. That was a slight that the Last Breath might not forgive.
Have that corpse disposed of in a manner that none will see, she ordered quietly. Utterly destroy the armor. No one must know that this warrior died by our weapons.
Mistress, Zesk said, his tone and stance carefully balanced to avoid offense.
Incubi armor is superior and recognizable,
Dimera hissed, rounding on him. She understood what her Drakon was saying. The war suits of the Incubus shrines offered better protection than the armor of her trueborn, better even than her own. But to wear the armor of an incubus when one was not an incubus was to bring down destruction on one's own head. The entire shrine to which the armor belonged would respond to such an insult, and there was no guarantee that any other shrine would honor a contract to defend the wearer's life in such a situation.
It must go, she said. We cannot even risk returning it to the shrine, for they will realize that the weapons which pierced it were Drukhari. That warrior never made it through the portal. See to it that this becomes reality.
Yes, mistress, Zesk said, inclining his head. He snapped his fingers, and two of his trueborn leaped down from the venom to deal with the corpses. The societal chaff which existed near this portal had fled as the first fugitives from the orc invasion began spilling through, and although all were watching from a distance, none dared approach while an archon such as Dimera Thrace of the Hollow Heart was making her inspections. However, others with more steel in their spines were approaching. Dimera could see the dark specks of transports. Her own household would be among them. Raider after raider packed out with warriors in her cabal's distinctive yellow and purple plate. But there would be others. Word of the orc incursion had spread, partly due to her efforts and those of Maculitix, and partly through the organic spread of Drukhari whispers.
Take us to meet them, she ordered her pilot,
and her venom swung up higher into the air, facing the oncoming flotilla like the single target of a swarm of arrows. Dimera schooled her face and stilled her nerve, and deliberately altered her own perceptions. These were not arrows, not projectiles aimed at her with the intent to harm. They were supplicants, coming to her for leadership and wisdom. She raised her chin and prepared to greet them as such. The largest of the approaching shapes resolved itself into the double-hulled form of a Tantalus, a skimmer significantly larger than a standard raider. Such craft were rare and a mark of wealth and status. Dimera recognized it as belonging to the Cabal of the Falling Night, even before she saw its colors, which meant the figure standing tall on the command deck could only be Master Archon Sistriel Vern.
The Arrakir are within our walls, and the Cabal of the Hollow Heart slays our own warriors, Vern announced with macabre relish, as his craft slowed to a halt just outside of easy boarding range.
Dimera was none too comfortable about facing down the Tantalus's pulse disintegrator armament, but Vern's opening line suggested that he was out for blood in a metaphorical rather than literal sense, at least at the moment, lest he show himself up as a hypocritical fool in front of others. Archons were supposed to be duplicitous, of course, but the art lay in maintaining your facade until your final triumph was assured. Also, at least Vern had stopped, rather than continuing past Dimera as though she weren't there.
Are you here to assist, or merely to give your pleasure craft an airing?
Dimera inquired. That was not the subtlest of insults, since a Tantalus was a mighty weapon of war rather than a luxury barge, but neither was it sufficient to justify Vern opening hostilities. What was more, Dimera's raiders were here now, cruising past and taking up position behind her, while the other craft, plenty from the Cabal of the Falling Night, but also smaller cabals like the Moon Legion, the Silver Shadows and Blood's Gift, were stopping on the other side of the imaginary divide. This was not her cabal facing down all the others, Dimera reminded herself. This was the other Archons awaiting her leadership.
"What assistance do you require?" Vern asked lazily.
He was a true beauty, with an artificial tint of the faintest glacial blue to his pale skin, which gave him the appearance of an ice sculpture. His hair was a shock of purest white, tied up and decorated with crescent blades and shot through with shards of bone taken from his enemies, while his armour was a deep greenish grey.
"I have sealed Sabergate off," Dimera announced, watching to see who looked impressed with her quick thinking, who looked angered, who looked thoughtful. "The Arrakia are contained but must still be eliminated."
She surveyed the assembled force, a sizable one to be sure, but enough to convincingly defeat the invaders? She was unconvinced.
"Things would go more smoothly if the witch cults wished to bloody their blades."
"I am sure they would," Vern replied.
"And what of the covens?"
"I cannot speak for all, but the coven of the Red Harvest is here," a sibilant voice called.
The Red Harvest's vessels were rising up, and leading them was Maculatix on his own raider, with 10 of his most ferocious racks. The Homunculus's craft swiveled lazily around, and he and his followers settled into position. Alongside the raiders and venoms of the Cabal of the Hollow Heart. The statement was clear and obvious. One of Port Tavar's largest cabals and one of its largest covens were united, at least for now. It was a front, naturally, because Dimera had no love for Maculatix and he had none for her, but the leverage of their position was important. The other cabals were faced with a stark choice. Attempt to form an immediate conglomerate of their own, with the backstabbing and clawing for power that would accompany it, and risk losing all their standing. Openly oppose this new alliance alone, and risk destruction, or fall into line. It would be temporary. It would always be temporary. But for beings as long-lived as Drukhari, temporary could end up being a very long time indeed. And while that allowed underlings to hone their plans to dispose of their betters, it also encouraged them to wait for precisely the right moment rather than give in to the impatience that cursed lesser, briefer species. All Dimera had to do was ensure that the one perfect moment to overthrow her never materialised.
"Very well,"
Sister Ulverne said, casually, as though his question had been an innocent one rather than an implication that Dimera stood alone with no allies.
"What do you propose?"
"We would be best served by the witch cult's speed," Dimera said. "The Arrakia are ferocious and resilient, as we well know, but lumbering and cumbersome. We must avoid a direct engagement. Hellions and Reavers should strike and disorientate them, doing damage and enraging them while keeping their distance. Our firepower will be most effective when they are truly disorganized. The Cabals can then provide the support needed for the witches themselves and the foot troops of the covens." She gestured to Maculatix. "To close the distance and carve them apart."
"We should move quickly," Vern said.
He was all business now, at least on the surface.
"The Arrakia possessed little ability at constructing true fortifications, but their crude structures still play to their strengths and could disrupt hit-and-run tactics. Better to strike before they begin adapting their surroundings to suit themselves."
"I have already sent out communiques to the cults," Dimera said. "However, I believe we will have greater success if my fellow Archons did the..."
She broke off as something exploded to her right. It was not the pulsing flash of a disintegration cannon or the sputtering darkness of a dark lance. It was a loud detonation and a cloud of smoke, such as might be caused by primitive explosives launched by a solid fuel propellant. Orc weapons, for example.
"What is happening?"
she queried by carrier wave, pitching the signal wide for all her troops in the area. Answer me! The first response was the chatter of gunfire, this time to her left. Not the near-silent spitting of splinter weapons, but the full-throated roar of simple projectiles. Then the shouting reached them. The distinctive one-note war cry of the Irakia. It was crude and it was brutish, but it also reached into the hindbrain and caressed it with blunt, rough fingers. This, it said to the Drukhari, was the voice of beings who were very unlikely to be afraid. Beings that would not stop until they were dead, which was harder to achieve than might be convenient. Beings that would never, ever give up their power. And it was a voice that should not be here. Have any portals been missed? Dimera demanded. All portals were sealed, Zesk replied immediately. None have been reopened. Something else exploded a little farther away, and that sound was immediately followed by loud and raucous cheering. Dimera looked around in frustration, taking little comfort from the fact that her rivals seemed just as confused as she was. Then, how are they doing this? Chapter 7 Uftak looked at the portal, which was almost the mirror of the ones through which they'd already come. This one, however, was different, in that the mysterious shimmering lights which had characterized the others were absent. It was inert, inoperative.
Not Zoggin working, boss, as de Boffin had put it.
The Wah had chased the spikies through one portal into the weird tunnel place, and then through another portal into wherever they were now. The spikies' home, or at least part of it. All around him, Uftak could hear the noise of the spikies who lived here doing their best to drive his lads away, and the boys giving them what for in no uncertain terms. Spikies always loved to show up, shank a few gits and disappear again. Uftak thought it was highly appropriate that someone had finally dropped into their camp and set about violently rearranging the scenery. But something was bothering him. Try as he might, he couldn't stop thinking about how weird it was that he and his lads had got through two of those portals, what normally needed a scrawny to open them, but were now stuck at this one.
Mogra, he said thoughtfully. You ever get the feeling that someone thinks they're smarter than you? All the time, boss, Mogrot said, nodding.
Uftak looked sideways at him, then grunted.
Yeah, fair point.